Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, longtime 60 Minutes producer Ira Rosen is going to be joining us to talk about all those iconic 60 Minutes stories. And we got the news coming up as well.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Hey, Ace, funny thing about Andrew Cuomo, huh? He went from Emmy Award winner to getting ME2'd.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, speaking of Emmy Award winning, our next guest, Ira Rosen, has won 24 Emmy Awards in 40 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, I only built shelves for 20 of them, so it was a problem.
New book, Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes, available now on Amazon. Well, this has always been one of my favorite shows, so I'm interested in all that's gone on behind the scenes there. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you show up in 1980 as a segment producer?
No, I showed up as a little pisher in 1980 with barely enough journalism experience to get a job as a copy boy in Long Beach, California. And what happened was Don Hewitt had seen a story I'd done locally and liked it. And Don was the creator of 60 Minutes, and he operated out of a sense of touch. He didn't need a resume to say if he liked you or didn't like you. And when I sat down with Don, I told him that I learned the art of storytelling from working the lights in the Catskill hotels, the comedians, Henny Youngman, Jan Murray, Red Buttons. And what their genius was, they told a joke, like, take my wife, please. Four words, beginning, middle, and end, has motivation. Or I'm going to take my wife to a place she's never been before, the kitchen.
Kitchen.
Right. So, yeah. So, you know, it has that sort of rhythm to it. And that's the way I always thought TV stories should be told. I said this to Don and he says, me too. That's where I learned storytelling. And so he walks me down the hallway into Mike Wallace's office and he says, it doesn't matter if I like you, he has to. Mm-hmm. And Don tried to make me at first comfortable. Mike wanted me to be uncomfortable. So he sits me down and he says, an amazing question. He says, I know what I could do for you. What could you do for me? And I really didn't have a good answer because I couldn't think of one. And then I noticed there was a tennis ball in the corner of his office. I said, you play tennis. And he said, what's it to you? And so I said, well, I was on the Cornell tennis team. And he said later, he figured he'd get 6 months of tennis out of me before firing me. So that's how I got my start with the guy in 1980.
Did Wallace, am I remembering right that Wallace's son is the one who had that tragic accident in Greece? Like he fell down a mountainside?
No, you're right. Yeah. No, he had two boys, Peter and Chris. Chris, you obviously know. And Peter was the one who was hiking in Greece and fell off the side of a mountain. And Mike didn't hear from him for a few weeks. So he went back to Greece and he was the one who ended up discovering the body. Peter was on a way to a monastery to visit an old monastery. And can you imagine looking down the side of a mountain and seeing your son's body at the bottom? And it changed his life forever because he decided at that point that he's going to take up what Peter wanted to do, which was being a journalist. At the time, Mike was doing fluffo commercials and cigarette commercials, and he had kind of a lame show on TV. But he decided to turn his life around and he went into CBS News and he took a big pay cut and the rest is his. By the way, during that period of time, he got friendly with Richard Nixon, and Nixon had offered him the job of press secretary, which Ron Ziegler later took. And so Mike had a choice: go to be Richard Nixon's press secretary or start the show that this crazy guy Don Hewitt wanted to start, which was 60 Minutes. Pretty good choice.
How many years has 60 Minutes been running now?
53. Not bad, right?
That's crazy. Yeah. Second only to South Park in terms of longevity, people. Wow. And also, there's been a lot of they've done a lot of satellites. I don't mean satellite stuff, but I just mean there's 60 Minutes Australia, right? There's 60 Minutes in Europe. I guess they've franchised, right?
They franchised the name, but they can't franchise the magic. The magic is the art of storytelling, which you do, and which, you know, anybody who's kind of does this stuff for a living does well. And what Don Hewitt's, the secret sauce of 60 Minutes is tell me a story. And that's, and Don actually wrote a book called Tell Me a Story. And that's what we was ingrained to us at the very beginning. When I would be doing this book, you know, some people take notes. I would be writing stories, you know, from what I did, you know, for, I mean, I met Marlon Brando, and, you know, Marlon Brando was in his time, the world's greatest actor. And he and I got to know each other a little bit. And I'd call him up in April when it was his birthday. And I'd say, "Hey, Marlon, happy birthday." He said, "What is it with you guys? Birds don't celebrate birthdays. Trees don't celebrate birthdays. Animals don't celebrate birthdays. Marlon, I'm just calling you up to wish you a happy birthday. I don't care." And then he would call me up. And by the way, that he never said, "Hello, how are you?" He would just start talking, and it would last 10 minutes. And then he would just abruptly hang up. So one day he calls me up and he says, "You ever know these people who have these great reputations who are really assholes?" And I said, "Marlon, I got to meet somebody at a local bar." And he said, he ignores the comment. He said, "Charlie Chaplin, great reputation, total asshole. William Saroyan, great reputation and total asshole." And I said, "Marlon, listen, can we talk about this later?" And then he starts reading me Saroyan, and in that Brando voice. And needless to say, I stuck around for the duration of that. It was pretty cool. Ultimately, Mike Wallace, myself, and him had dinner in off of Mulholland Drive, and Mike can't resist himself, and Marlon can't resist. So he says to Mike, "You know, Mike, I've admired you for a long time for your acting ability." And he says, "What are you talking about? I'm a journalist." "No, no, you're a great actor. The raised eyebrow, the look of astonishment. You know, you're a genius." So Mike decides to give it back to him. "How did you get so fat?" And he says, "Well, I go to Baskin and Robbins. I can't decide what flavor ice cream I want. So I end up ordering every flavor they have, and I bring it home and I eat it all." At which point, you know, he says, "Mike, I'm 67 years old. I don't need to establish my reputation by showing America what an a-hole you are. Let's just be friends." And I, of course, go crazy. So Brando had one final conversation with me after that. He didn't want to have much to do with me after that dinner. So he calls me up and he said, "You play the stock market?" I said, "A little bit. I don't have much money." He said, "Well, let me give you a tip." I said, "What's that?" "Company called Apple." I said, "I never heard of it." He said, "You will. I'm telling you, trust me, put all your money into it." So I go to Wallace and I say, "Hey, Mike, you know, I just had this conversation. Brando, he tells me about this company called Apple. He said, you're going to buy the stock?" I said, "Are you crazy? Why would I take a stock tip from a guy who can't decide what flavor ice cream he wants?"
Wow. What year was the Apple conversation?
It was like 84. Yeah. And Steve Jobs wanted Brando to do commercials at that time. So he approached him. And, you know, so he found out a little bit about the company. The company had obviously gone public, was being traded, but, you know, people didn't, you know, it was, I'm sure some people focused on it, but not a lot.
I was just literally in my shop an hour and a half ago looking at the Apple. So I have the first race car that Apple sponsored back in 1980. So they were doing well enough in 1980 that they could sponsor a Porsche 935 for a season, which is an expensive car, to go to Le Mans, go to Paris or France, race at Le Mans, and race at all these big races. But it is weird when you're looking at the car and you're just looking at the pictures and the old pictures of the car. And it's funny because I do always think of Apple as kind of a new company, but we're now kind of knocking on the door 50 years, right? I mean, if they were sponsoring a 935 in 1980, 1981, that wasn't two guys in a garage at that point. I mean, they were selling some units. It's kind of crazy to think that we are coming up on, I mean, I don't know, we're 45 years, 46 years. I'd have to, somebody could figure it out. But yeah, that's what I was doing 2 hours ago, staring at an Apple livery on a car. I don't own any stock either, but I should have. I bought the car. Who did you? I'm looking down these list of hosts through the years, and I have my favorites. You know, Ed Bradley left us too early. Was he the best?
Everybody loved the guy. Everybody wanted to work with him. He had just this magic about him. He would take his suits and he would just change his entire wardrobe and throw it away every 3 years.
Before we move from Ed Bradley, I'm sorry, you may know where this is going. Can you please, as somebody with some insight, tell us about the earring? The world stopped turning when we saw the earring.
Yeah. Ed was, Ed loved his jazz and loved his music. And he would become a major fixture at Jazz Fest in New Orleans. And one day he just decided to put an earring on. You know, the fellow musicians got him into it and he just wore it. And, you know, it fit perfectly with him. It was great.
Yeah.
He used to go down there and play. There's a song, 60 Minutes Man. And he'd take the stage of whatever band was playing it and he'd play tambourine. He was just cool.
And I think he paved the way for the old guy earring. I got to believe without Ed Bradley, there would be no Harrison Ford earring.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think you're right. I think you're exactly right. Yeah.
Once again, the white man ripping off the black man's culture.
Every time.
You know what I mean? So I liked, I'm going to go for a deeper cut. I always liked Scott Pelley. Am I saying his name right? Scott Pelley.
Scott Pelley, yeah.
Pelley, yeah. Scott Pelley. I don't know why. I like that guy. I liked, Harry Reasoner was awesome. Mike Wallace, of course, morally safer. I don't know. Will we ever... Can we ever? First off, what kind of numbers was 60 Minutes doing at the height of its powers? Because, you know, it was always appointment viewing Sunday night. You know, you could hear the iconic opening, the stopwatch ticking. Yeah, like was that a top five show, top three show?
It was the number one show in the country. Probably hitting 30 million viewers easy. I wrote in my book that it had an audience that rivaled the Super Bowl today at its height. And that's what was so amazing. When they kind of gave me a job, they were the number one show in the country. And they assigned me to the number one correspondent in the country. And you were mentioning those people. I mean, Scott is a master at putting together a story. He learned from Don that sense of storytelling. Harry Reasoner was another one who was a genius. He did this story. You may remember it. They were selling off the movie set Casablanca, and they were selling it off piece by piece. And he did a story about that. I mean, who would ever think of doing that? And he sat in a tuxedo and he said, you know, everyone remembers who they saw the movie Casablanca with. And if she's looking in right now, here's looking at you, kid. And he took a belt and, you know, it was just magical. Morley Safer going down on the Orient Express, the last train ride in Europe, and the majesty of that. Harry did a story once, which I always loved, about old people driving in Florida, where the problem is, you know, so on one hand, they can't drive. But on the other hand, if you take away their license, they're dead. They're dead. They're just going to sit at their home and die. So the judges end up letting them keep their licenses, even though some of them are half blind. And it was a story that 40 or 50, whatever number of years later, it still has resonance to it. People still remember that story.
I could remember. I have these weird little flashbacks. The piece is like when they interviewed Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he would pretend to fall asleep and then pop right. up and scare the crap out of, I don't know who was, trying to think of who interviewed. Well, he's probably been on multiple times. They're weird little.
No, but that was a fantastic story. The producer on that, John Hamlin, actually had known about that little scene beforehand and was able to sort of, have it play out to play a little bit of a gag on Ed. These are incredible stories that were done. They stay in your memory.
Do you guys know that story?
60 Minutes was never not on
there,
in our house.
There's one, and I won't help you at all because I just have this little glimpse, but I was probably watching when I was 19, and it struck me as bizarre. They were interviewing some Idi Amin type, some guy who was the tyrannical ruler of some banana republic or something, and they're interviewing him at a big like gathering, an outdoor gathering, a festival, a celebration of, and whoever's interviewing him said to him, and he was like, you know, out of central casting with the big general outfit on and everything. And they said to him, in your country, there's so much oppression of women and rape. And the guy goes, look around. Do you see anyone being raped? And I just remember thinking, he was at a cocktail party, like in the palace, you know? And I just remember thinking, what an insane statement. Like, how can you say there's rape in my country? Look, we have an open bar. We have a cheese platter over here. You don't see anyone being raped, do you?
Hardly any.
Well, the great one was, of course, when Mike Wallace interviewed the Ayatollah Khomeini, where he sat there and he said, you know, this is the hostages are taken and this is the first big interview with the Ayatollah. And Mike says to him, you know, Anwar Sadat, who was head of Egypt at the time, Anwar Sadat called you a lunatic. Not me. Forgive me. Not me. Him.
Right.
And you could see, you know, and the Ayatollah is not even looking at Mike. It's like, you know, this guy fly on my suit. And then suddenly he looks up at the guy and says, basically, you know, Sadat is going to get his.
And he got it, right? He was
exactly. We all know what happened later on.
He was assassinated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there must have been, I mean, it's still going on, but there had to be a kind of a high fear level going into some of those places.
Well, I did a story. Yeah. I have it in my book where I did the story in Pakistan. And what happens is you feel the danger more sitting in New York City or in the U.S. When you're in Pakistan, you don't feel the danger. And this is like right after 9/11. And like an idiot, I decide to go to the local Red Mosque where this guy Razi was. His English was better than mine. And I figured, oh, you know, he speaks pretty good English. How bad can this guy be? He was the Al-Qaeda guy inside Islamabad. So I go in and I do the interview with him. And it's a pretty good interview. And, you know, he's completely insane. But, you know, whatever. Nobody's perfect. So we go into the back of the madrasa. And my CBS fixer is there. And suddenly the two of them are yelling at each other in Urdu. And, like, I'm shaking my head. You know, I'm smiling. Yeah, you know, this is cool. And my CBS guy takes me by the shirt and grabs me and hauls me out outside, gets me into the car, and he starts heaving. And I said, what just happened? And he said, well, they were talking about making you another Daniel Pearl. Daniel Pearl was the journalist who was beheaded.
Right.
And they're talking about making you another Daniel Pearl. And I told them that if they kidnap you, my brother is the police chief in Kohat, a nearby town, and he's going to track every one of the members of your family down by morning and slaughter them. And this is how they talk in Pakistan. And that bought me a minute, you know, like, I don't know, should we allow our parent, you know, to get slaughtered, or do we want to accept
right.
to New York? So we got away. But I had no idea what was going on.
In the book, you say Katie Couric is lazy, Diane Sawyer is two-faced, and Chris Cuomo's entitled. Maybe we should talk a little about that. Chris Cuomo's sort of in the news now, certainly with his brother. What do you mean by entitled?
Well, actually, I didn't say that was a tabloid headline. That was taken out of context. I worked with Chris, and I actually kind of liked him. He was very upfront, very direct. And as I wrote in my book, you know, I was wrong about the guy. He was able to turn his style and his personality around to sort of make something of himself on CNN. And he made that persona kind of work for him on TV. What I actually, you know, when the book gets sort of taken away from you in a tabloid world, you sort of lose control of it. But actually, you know, Diane Sawyer and I did some amazing stories together. She's an amazing TV correspondent, writer, storyteller. And so, you know, I'm proud of the work we did there.
Well, walk us through the process.
So sure.
I think a lot of Americans are a little jaded and they think, you know, well, the reporter sits down and reads the teleprompter that someone else loaded up and, you know, travels around, does an interview and stuff. But they probably don't know how involved they are in the actual story. So, like, work it from the pitch. I mean, I guess I've been in writers' rooms a lot, not doing news, but you do comedy and you go, here's my pitch. Here's what I think would be a good idea. This would be funny. We should do this. And, you know, you kind of spitball it and sometimes they work and oftentimes they don't. But at some point, if we go, okay, let's do it, then you're the person that has to write that script and sort of bring that thing to fruition, to life. So just sort of walk us through, you know, Monday morning, or do they give you Monday? They give you Monday off.
No. It's not Monday off. But what you do is there's something called a blue sheet system, which is a quick claim deed on a story. Usually in the old days, it was whatever was in the New York Times that day. And you try to get your blue sheet in. And then if you do, you own that story. But a lot of times it's just reading magazines, talking to sources. So one day, one of my favorite stories, I was reading a magazine about truffles. You know what truffles are, black Sure. truffles, white truffles. Dogs dig them out in the ground in France.
Or pigs, right?
They used to use pigs, but the pigs ended up eating the truffle.
Yeah, dogs
Yeah.
do it now.
Dogs do it now. So what I discovered was that the Chinese had found the truffle, you know, and a handful of truffles could cost $1,000.
Oh, yeah. I remember this story well. I know this story very well. Yeah, like bootleg and truffles, right?
You got it. And so in China, they found a knockoff.
I know.
No, they found a knockoff of the truffle that they were feeding to the pigs as sort of waste. And they said, the hell with the pigs, let's feed them to the French. So they started exporting the Chinese truffles that taste basically like rubber, and they sent it to France. And then the restaurants in France started selling them to the American visitors, you know, black truffles. And so they said, well, they're black truffles and they're in France. So we're black truffles from France. And the dumb American visitors didn't know the difference. Oh, this tastes so good. It tastes like rubber. It had no smell. It was, you know. So I said, how about that story? And the guy was a little skeptical. And I said, no, it's a great story. And, you know, it has a little bit of it has food and an expose attached to it. So I said, okay, go for it. So I go over to France and I meet up with Olga Urbani, who ran the largest truffle operation in the world. And she ends up going truffle hunting with us, wearing a full length mink coat with Leslie Stahl. And it was just the most fun story. And then in the end, we end up confronting one of these people who repackaged the Chinese truffles as French truffles. So it had a bit of an investigative story to it. And when we screened it, you know, the executive producer walks in and he sort of says, oh, so this is the mushroom story, huh? And so Leslie says, just watch the story and shut up. I said, okay. So we watched the story and jumps up. He said, now that's a 60-minute story. And that's like the highest compliment you could get. So it's the beginning, middle, and end of it is the producer certainly sometime, most of the time, finds the story, puts it together, researches it, writes it. And, you know, if you're in the hands of, you know, and my two favorite correspondents were Leslie Stahl and Bill Whitaker. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the hands of those two, they elevate it. Mike Wallace, when he did an interview, turned a B into an A. That was the real genius of Mike. He could look at a total stranger and know exactly what button to push to drive them crazy. He was a master at this sort of thing.
What was tape day on 60 Minutes?
Well, what you do is you put together the stories in an edit room.
Right.
Then you screen it, then you go through, you know, revisions. And then what they do is on Friday afternoons, the correspondents tape the intros that you see every Sunday with mm-hmm. the name of the producer behind it, the best credit in TV. And then they put it together in the control room there, marrying your story with what you see at the beginning of the piece intro. And that's when they marry the ticking clock and all that stuff. So it's basically all packaged on Friday night. Unless they're crashing a story. And if they're crashing a story, it would be packaged sometimes literally. It could be live or it could be maybe an hour before air, before the 7 o'clock hit time. And, you know, that's happened to me. You know, I did a story, even in the old time, I did a story once on Jesse Jackson running for president, the very, very first time. We taped it that Sunday morning in Don Hewitt's office. And I edited the piece together, and then we married it, a half hour before broadcast.
What year was the truffle story? Do you recall?
Oh, boy. Let me think.
And maybe Chris can look it up. But,
it's one of the largest. You could go on YouTube now. It has, like, you know, several million views. It's one of the most viewed pieces.
What year? I'm seeing 2012.
2012. Yeah.
Okay.
It is really the truffle story, and I'm not just saying it because you're here, but that's really the genius of 60 Minutes. I'm from North Hollywood. I grew up eating macaroni and cheese from a box and, you know, SpaghettiOs from a can. I don't think I'd even tasted a truffle, sadly, at 2012. And I was fascinated, riveted. But, you know, you're so used to news. I guess the real key is, how do you take this thing that doesn't inherently sound interesting? It sounds like a mushroom story, and make it super fascinating, you know? And
the way you do it is, yes. I'm a little ADD, and that's helpful in TV. So if I get bored, I just move on. So what I did in that truffle story, one of the elements that I was amazed by is that in Sunday church, people, you know, put money into the contribution plate.
Right.
In France, they put truffles into the contribution plate. And I heard this. I said, are you serious? Yeah. You know, farmers, you know, they just throw a truffle.
Pretty valuable.
Yeah. And so I got a film crew to go there, think of the expense, just to get the farmer putting the truffle into the contribution plate. And because it was just a moment that you just will remember.
It's also, I feel like it's an easier pitch if you say to Leslie Stahl, like, you want to go to Beirut again? Or,
hold on.
Or, I have a killer idea where we end up in France. How about that? Eating truffles.
Yeah, no, look, you're exactly right. When I mentioned it to Leslie, she just said, I love it. When do we go?
Yeah, right.
She ended up bringing her husband, you know.
I knew it. It's so, listen, it's
he kept wandering into the shot. And it's like,
the guy's, you know, figured this out is Adam Sandler, you know, like, hey, we're doing another movie in Maui. All right. When do you want us there?
Last thing about the truffle story, we ended up, there was a guy in the south of France, Bruno. And Bruno is the largest restaurateur for truffles. They would fly in on helicopters just to eat lunch in Bruno's. And the number one dish was a boiled potato, little cream on it, little salt and pepper, and black truffle on top. It was to die for. You figured, what? Huh? It's all in the technique.
Yeah, man. I can taste it. I can smell it. Yeah. I don't know. Is there any? All right. You know, it's good. Even just a truffle oil or even those. I'll tell you a tip.
You know, truffle oil does not come from truffles. You know
just as long as it smells like it, that's fine. On a completely poor guy side note, for those who are trying to stay keto and you get those cheese chips, those little round sort of
crisp
things. There's one that's a cheddar with truffle.
Yes.
Goddamn delectable.
Yeah,
Ticking Clock, the name of the book, Behind the Scenes. It's 60 Minutes, available now on Amazon. Ira, this has been delightful.
Well, thank you so much for having this. This has been a lot of fun. I haven't talked about the truffle story. It makes me hungry. I think I'm going to get some mac and cheese. And
get some truffle. Ira Rosen, thank you so much for joining us. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with the news right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral. Weird crime, protest, politics. Give me news with Gino Grad. Stuff they saw on TMZ. Joe Biden. Kamala. Big news with Gina. Gina Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
We haven't heard anything about the Chris D'Elia story in a while, and a headline just popped up saying that he is facing a new lawsuit that accuses him of violating federal child pornography and sexual exploitation laws, including soliciting more than 100 sexually explicit photos and videos from a woman identified as Jane Doe, who was 17 when this went down. She had reached out to D'Elia in September of 2014 via Instagram, never expecting a reply. D'Elia was on his under no influence tour at the time. They communicated on Snapchat, according to the lawsuit. D'Elia's career took a hit last June after multiple women accused him via social media of sending graphic messages soliciting sex. In some cases, the women had gone to see him in person and described inappropriate behavior seeking sex. Five of D'Elia's accusers spoke to the LA Times. Some of the women were underage at the time. And I have a statement from Jane Doe. This is what she said in a recent statement. She says, "When I was in my final year of high school and still a child, I was groomed by a celebrity twice my age. Chris D'Elia abused his status and fame to lure me in, take advantage, and manipulate me when I was at a vulnerable age. I want any other girls out there to know that they are not alone, and it's time to get justice for the mental and physical toll he has put us through."
You know, I always talk about, like, how insidious something like being addicted to gambling is, you know, because everyone always talks about addiction to drugs, alcohol, pain meds, you know, that kind of stuff.
Opioids,
but yeah, you can make it. You can be an alcoholic and put in some good years. Hell,
that's right.
Write some great plays and movies. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Be celebrated.
You can be celebrated. Like, you can be on Vicodin and keep your day job for a while or whatever. But I always said, like, when you're addicted to gambling, it just fucks you up immediately. Like, you just go right through the money and look no further than Lost in America. But I think about, like, when you have kids, you kind of go like, and you go like, here's what I would wish for them. Here's what I wouldn't wish for them. Think about a kind of libido, like a sexual libido that's a little off. You know what I mean? Like, you like underage people, or you like young girls or young boys, or it's just this crazy appetite where it's like, every time I go on the road, I got to hook up with somebody. I can't just, you know, beat off and go to bed with the rest of us, you know,
with your plastic cup and your red wine.
That's right. Sometimes in a mug.
Yeah.
Depending.
Well, plastic cups over the wine.
Right. But the point is you realize, like, how many prominent people will just be undone, maybe not in the past, but from this day forth, and we're now on the clock, just what a life, career, all-encompassing destroyer just being essentially going, I like young chicks, you know, I like young and I like a variety, you know what I mean? Like I can't get enough. Like just if you, and by the way, once you're kind of burdened with that or saddled with that or whatever it is, that's just kind of your thing. Like, you know, it's not here to defend pedophiles, but give me 20 minutes. I'm saying this is, I bet those guys wish they weren't into that shit.
Sure.
But they are. And now it shall destroy them and destroy others and destroy their families and their communities. And it's
their
like,
career.
It is. You know, you should hope, and there's kind of a weird thing. Like, you don't want your son to be a eunuch, you know, a healthy libido, but at some point you would wish for them this sort of balance, you know, like, well, have a few girlfriends in college and then meet somebody you marry and stay married forever and have intercourse with that person. But when it's such a career killer now, or just being into something weird like Army Hammer, you know what I mean? Or yeah. Marilyn Manson, like Army Hammer. I still don't really know what he did other than was weird, which is kind of enough. Chris yeah. D'Elia, I don't know everything about the underage stuff. Some of the non-underage stuff just seemed weird. You know, just kind of creepy, like, hey, I'm a good-looking guy. I'm a celebrity. Like, come up to my room. I'll answer the door naked, you know. Like, off-putting. But, and again, those moves where it's like they were eating at a restaurant and he stood up to use the bathroom. And the next thing you know, he was rubbing his ball sack on the back of my neck. Like, does that ever work?
It must. Why else
How could it ever work?
It must.
I
didn't know he was interested.
We were sitting in a synagogue, and he said he had to use the bathroom, and I felt his penis rubbing the back of my neck. It's like,
no, not his payas, his penis.
Right. Like, how does that work? Yeah. Does it ever work?
It must. It must. Why else would they try that?
Yeah.
Why else is that in the repertoire?
Yeah.
Does a pitcher throw a screwball if it doesn't work? No, it works sometimes. Sometimes you get knocked out of the park. Sometimes you strike the guy out.
It's a numbers game.
Noted. The one that they always do, but I just don't think ever works. But Brian's right. We only hear about it when it doesn't work,
exactly.
You know, because then the governor sat down next to me and he picked up my hand and he put it on his crotch and he asked me if I liked scrambled eggs for breakfast, and I ran out of the room crying. But you don't hear the stories where the governor picked up my hand, put it on his crotch, and I blew him in the limo.
That's between us.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it out.
Brian's right. There may be very many success stories that we just never hear about.
Yeah.
Think about every sports cheating scandal, doping or deflating the ball or whatever, like, or anything involving the Patriots, you know, filming the other team's sidelines. It must work. They must go on all the time.
Yeah. So Chris D'Elia, who I haven't really heard anything from, has he been performing?
I don't think so.
His
agent dropped him. Manager dropped him.
In a weird way, you think about stuff like anyone who got caught up with Me Too during COVID has the timing's never good to get Me Too'd, but the COVID timing, if you live in Los Angeles, is pretty good because these guys, and I know it from being there, were – you know, fixtures at the Comedy Store, fixture at the Laugh Factory, fixtures at the Improv. You just see every Saturday night, every Wednesday night. They were just there.
Right.
And so it would be super weird because it would be super obvious that you weren't showing up for a reason, but now no one's showing up for any reason. So it's not
COVID,
it's not nearly as glaring. But anyway, well, he's been funny as shit on this show when he does Jean-Claude Van Damme, and I hope none of this is true. But you gotta listen to everyone's story and weigh the evidence, and we'll see where this one goes down. I still don't know what's happening with Armie Hammer.
We'll stay on that. But he does have a quote that the LA Times picked up. And I think this is from YouTube. Let's see. The date of this is February. So he said, "Sex, it controlled my life. It was my focus all the time. And I had a problem. And I do have a problem. It's not like months down the line, everything's better. I need to work on that."
Well, it's kind of what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
You know, somebody is going to have to make a movie where the story is this kind of knock around comedian, maybe journeyman type, you know, been on the road his whole career, you know, not a headliner per se, and had the reputation with getting with all the waitresses at the club and taking home the groupies or the fans back to the hotel that night and cheap motels and all that kind of stuff. And just a profile of a guy who was like a kind of journeyman. I'm not talking about a guy in his 60s, but just a guy had been at it since 1920 and is now 35 or something. Does a set, you know, at the Laugh Factory on a Sunday night, somebody's in the audience, sort of discovers him, wants him to make him the new host of The Bachelor or whatever it is. And this guy does the math. Like, if I get high profile for 10 seconds, there's going to be 2,000 people I've betted on the road for the last 20 years. Like, just, it's going to be a shit show immediately. Like, the only reason this guy's existing is because people don't know his name.
Right.
But he still gets to slide into the club, do his set, you know, gets paid. And so now he's got his crappy manager and his flunky agent, and they're both telling him, like, you gotta do this. This is the biggest break of your life. That show's the number one show on TV. You'll have the number one spot on the number one. And he's like, But he's been saying to the manager the whole time, "What are you doing? I can't, but where's my break?"
Give me a gig.
Right, right. It's going to, I mean, you got to imagine there's people that are thinking this way now, right? Like,
yeah. Sure. And like Brian said, you know, we don't know about the ones that did do the math, because they didn't become a household name and they didn't get busted.
Brian says the sack on the back of the neck works every time. That's what I heard.
That's anecdotal.
He's only
talking about himself.
That's right. I can tell you from empirical evidence.
Gina, hand on the crotch. I take your hand, I put on my crotch. Is that ever going to... maybe it works in a domestic setting. I don't feel like it works in public, right?
It depends. I'm okay. What I'm doing in my head, remember you said, like, if it's unwanted and the guy is not hot, it's always, you know, it's an assault. But if this is someone you're into, am I down? Even if he was super, super hot and I was down, I would still be put off by that move. Because that's mechanical. That's something he's done 100 times.
Yeah.
You can't go after a girl like Gina with self-esteem.
Thank you.
Self-respect. You can't.
Well, I told you. I told you when I first moved here, I went on a date with that dude, and we sat on his futon because the couch was too rich for his blood, and he whipped it out, and he wouldn't let me out of his apartment. So dudes do this.
The futon is diabolical, because if you have 2 glasses of wine, you can't get up off a futon. You're essentially like a turtle. It's been flipped on its shell. There's getting up from a futon.
You're waiting for the kindness of strangers.
And when you put the turtle's purse on the opposite side of the door, that's something. That's probably another move you've done before. You smartened up that time.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way to get my purse.
That's right.
It works.
Smart. Yeah, that guy's a hero. Sorry. Who else? What happened? Who's done what?
Well, let's move on to Alec Baldwin and Hilaria. They've welcomed their 6th child together. Oh. This is now Alec's 7th child, only 5 months after she gave birth to their son, Eduardo. Hilaria broke the news on Instagram with a photo of little baby Lucia alongside Eduardo, Romeo Alejandro David, Leonardo Angel Charles, Rafael Thomas, and Carmen Gabriela.
Staying with the Latin theme.
Yeah, wow. Yep. So the math will tell you that this was probably a surrogate, since this was, you know, 5 months after she had another baby. But in true Alec Baldwin fashion, standing by his woman, colorfully. There was a little back and forth on her, you know, on the post from a fan who was questioning a lot of this and said, who is the mother? She wasn't pregnant. She gave birth 6 months ago. If it was a surrogate, just say that. If the baby was adopted, just say that. If the baby was the product of an affair and you've decided to raise it with your wife, just say that. If you don't want to say anything, there's more. If you don't want to say anything, why don't you stop constantly posting and begging for clickbait? Just raise your 100 children in private. To which Alec replied, you shut the fuck up and mind your own business.
Yeah.
I'm kind of with Alec on this one.
I'm with Alec too. And
I want to post pictures of your kid regardless of where they came from. There's no obligation to tell people how you had the child.
Let's not forget, he was one of the early pioneers of almost being canceled with this piggy phone message with his daughter, right?
That was
07?
I'm going to guess 2005 or 2006, because I remember I was when I heard that.
I think we were doing the morning radio. I think it would have been 6 or 7, because I think we were doing the KLSX show there. And I do kind of remember where I was. And it was like, that was much ado about nothing. I'm sure he was at his wit's end with his crazy ex-wife and scheduling and, like, you know, saying, like, I'll call you, or I'll pick you up at this time. And she never picked up the phone. And she was probably, Kim Basinger was probably fucking with her head. And he just went off because he's just, you know, he's that guy. Yep. 07, so says Max Zapata. But it's like, remember how we went nuts on that? Called her a disrespectful little piggy. Yes. And also, you're the product of Kim Basinger and Alec Baldwin. No, you're not going to be hurting in the looks department. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's just a dad from the New York area teeing off on his daughter.
And he said, rude, thoughtless pig.
Right.
So that's where that anger was coming from, not, you know, trying to destroy her self-esteem in the looks department.
I was going to say, do we have a picture of this person these days? She got
Ireland?
I saw her.
She was at the roast.
I hung out a little with her at the roast. She's, you know, 6'3". And
she's
look.
I imagine so.
If she's a pig, then you should be hunting for truffles.
There you go.
Yeah, she's a bit of all right. I don't think there's anything Kim Basinger can produce that's going to slide below an 8. I think that, I feel like that would be mathematically impossible.
Have you seen most of her movies?
not in Rotten Tomatoes. All right, let me hit. All right, let's do another one, Gina.
All right. Well, this one is fantastic, and I can't wait to show you the video. A plastic surgeon in California was multitasking his virtual traffic hearing so that he could do it while performing surgery.
Wow.
And the state medical board isn't super happy about it. Dr. Scott Green joined his Zoom trial in full surgical scrubs from the operating room and informed the other attendees that despite being in surgery, he could totally proceed with the trial. Fortunately for the patient on the slab, the judge said he would need to reschedule for when he wasn't literally cutting someone open. Here's a clip from the actual trial. It's pretty funny.
So unless I'm mistaken, I'm seeing a defendant that's in the middle of an operating room appearing to be actively engaged in providing services to a patient. Is that correct, Mr. Green?
Yes, sir.
Or what should I say, Dr. Green, but I don't know that.
Okay. That's okay.
I do not feel comfortable for the welfare of a patient, if you're in the process of operating, that I would put on a trial, notwithstanding the fact that the officer's here today.
I have another surgeon right here who's doing the surgery with me, so I can stand here and allow them to do the surgery also.
Not at all. I don't think so. I don't think that's appropriate. I think I'm going to come up with a different date when you're not actively involved or participating in attending to the needs of a patient. Let me see if I can get a different date here.
I kind of like the cut of this guy's jib.
Is that just an FU to the cop, to the
judge
system?
Doctor?
Yeah, he's giving him the hi hat. Was he? That was traffic. That was a traffic court thing.
Yeah.
Because the biggest insult So, and I don't know what the infraction was, but if it's a chicken shit infraction, the biggest insult, like rolling through a four-way stop sign on a Sunday or something like that, is that you got to like go in, you got to like put your shit aside and go to them, you know?
Yeah.
And then if the cop doesn't show up, they'll dismiss it, but you have to sit there for a long time. I think the doctor was kind of like, I'm fucking busy. And again, if the guy plowed through a farmer's market and took out a Cub Scout troop, that's something. But if it's a chicken shit kind of nuisance, time wasting a ticket, then good. Let the other doctor work on shit.
But how would you feel if you were the guy with the anesthesia in your arm or over your mouth?
Well,
that's true.
This must work, Gina. Otherwise, why would he try?
He said the other guy was working on him.
Yeah,
I don't know
there were two surgeons.
I don't know what that means, and who the hell knows? It's an elective surgery, right? He's a plastic surgeon.
Couldn't a skin graft from bomb victims.
He's probably getting a sack tuck.
Yeah.
Or
it's more likely.
A foreskin restoration or something, you know, a taxpayer's expense. Come on. You want to pay for this guy's foreskin restoration, Gina? Well, do you?
No, I don't.
Brian, do you?
Now that I think about it.
All right, but yet this hero can't conduct his business. Huh. It's interesting. I have no idea. I haven't gotten a ticket in a while because my head is on a goddamn swivel, and I've also figured out cop patterns. Mm-hmm. I don't think people fully like understand patterns and cop patterns. And I shall give you a for instance. There is a red light. I drive through all red arrows, but I drive through a red light as well. And it's like at the end of my street, and it's one of those little streets that goes out into the big street and it takes forever. And I drive through it every time because there's no cops. There's no cops around. I mean, you could get unlucky, but you look right down the boulevard and you look left down the boulevard and you look in your rearview mirror. If you don't see any cops, you just drive through. Now, as I always say, most people would never, ever do that. But they will happily go on a stretch of PCH on a beautiful day in Malibu and be driving at 63 miles an hour in a 45, you know, down the hill after you pass Pepperdine. And that's where the cops are.
Yep.
The cops, they figured out patterns. They're into patterns. They're not into going out and writing random tickets. They understand it's a long stretch of highway. People are looking at the ocean. You're like going down a hill.
Or they're by the stop sign at the bottom of the hill. The people always just, because your momentum just always kind of roll through.
There's a four-way stop sign a block from here. Everyone here has gotten a ticket at that stop sign. Because it's not that the cops are randomly driving by the intersection. When you roll through it, they get it. That's what people do.
Yep.
Nobody but me drives through red lights. So there is no pattern. There's never a cop. If everyone did, then they would. But the way people's brains are is they would freak out if you go through a red arrow, but they have no problem sailing down PCH at 15 miles an hour. And that's where you get the fucking tickets all the time. So once you kind of understand like kind of where the cops are, like number one rule of where cops are, downhill.
Yes.
They're not on the uphill side.
No.
So speed on the uphill side and then slow it down on the downhill side. They love to, like on the 2 freeway, they love to back it up. They love to be waiting on the on ramp.
Yeah,
so you can't see them and then you're just sailing down the hill. And they also know everyone's driving a modern car where 78 miles an hour on a clear day just feels like nothing when you're just barreling down the hill. But understand the rhythms of traffic cops. And then what you have to do is you can break all the fucking laws you want, but never do the California rolling stop through the four-way stop sign. Yeah, that's where they are. And when you're on PCH and you pass Pepperdine and you're heading down that back hill, fucking for that for that quarter mile or half mile, fucking slow it down.
When I must have been here a few years, when I rolled through a stop on Western in East Hollywood, I had my car impounded.
Really?
Yes. It was very late at night. I was coming home from a friend's house. No, I'll tell you in a second. I was coming home from a friend's house in Venice. I still had my suit on because this is when I was working in men's suiting. And I rolled through a stop of a dead neighborhood in East Hollywood. And I got lit up by two women. And I couldn't find my license. Turns out I had a hole in the lining of my purse. And, but I didn't know that at the time. So they impounded my car. They were going to leave me there in the middle of the night with all of the stuff they took out of my car. And I said, can you give me a ride home? And they said that was against their policy. And somebody had to come get me. So after begging and begging and begging, these two women finally gave me a ride home. My car was impounded for 4 days.
Just literally because you couldn't produce a license.
I couldn't find it. I was like, I swear to God, I have a license. They impounded me in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Well, good news is in Los Angeles, that wouldn't happen anymore. Like, you could get pulled over with no license, no insurance, and like 10 DUIs in your past, and they just go, fuck it.
Yeah, I did this backwards.
All right, let's bring it home, baby.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news.
Gina Grad! That was the news with Gina Grad.
All right. I'm going to label that show interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say.
Lots of thoughts.
A lot.
I want to thank Paul Wagner for zooming in. American Nightmare Season 2, of course. Ira Rosen as well. Ticking Clock, the book. And Reno, Virginia Street Brewhouse, March 19th and 20th, doing stand-up there. Come on by. And we're also doing the Jam in the Van out here on March 25th, two shows. And Dawson's going to be opening, and Adam Ray's going to be up there, too. So just go to adamcarolla.com for all that. And until next time, this is Adam for Ira and Paul and Gina and Bald saying mahalo.
The Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Find him on Facebook and Instagram at Adam Carolla. And then pick up your phone and dial 888-634-1744. Leave us a voicemail. And get Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. And all the links are at adamcarolla.com.